Israeli journalism. Voices were criticizing the actions of the Israeli government and the Israeli police. Not only that,
we have 5 seconds, Rami.
Okay, I'm sorry. I just wanted to say that the Israeli police are not telling the whole truth. If you confront them with the evidence, they're basically going to call you a liar. And
we're going to do part two with you and post online at democracynow.org and play a clip of that interview you did. Rami Yunus, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
And you're listening to radio station WUSB Stony Brook. It's 6 o'clock. Time for Off the Wall. Good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you, joined tonight by Kyle over there. Kyle?
Speaking.
You got to pick up your cues a little faster than that.
Speaking.
Good, good. How are you today?
A little frazzled. You know, I got this funny situation. I'm helping a friend out with some plumbing, and they have this sink, and it's got a crack in it.
Uh-huh.
Have you ever seen a cartoon where there's, like, you know, things bandaged up and like, a piece of thing, you know, a cloth wrapped around with a knot?
A tourniquet.
Yeah, and then there's, like, little leaks, like, spurting out everywhere.
Uh-huh, yeah.
It's that kind of crazy situation. I want to know, why is all plumbing like this? And, you know, people have been using all of their appliances more recently, so definitely it's a good thing to try to help your neighbor out.
Why are people using appliances more than now?
Because they're home more, I don't know.
Okay.
There's just a lot of wear and tear, and I don't know. It's one more thing. It's hard to concentrate. There's so much going on when you have a situation like this, and I really want to help the guy out, but, you know, it's complicated.
When did you turn into a plumber?
I wear many. No, this has been going on. That's a whole other show. I wear many hats.
Yeah, well, we're literally not going to talk about the kitchen sink tonight.
Everything but
the kitchen sink. But well, we've already talked about the kitchen sink, so there's no reason
to.
No,
I submitted my thoughts. We're going to help get this person a better sink. a better, I think better materials. This thing just, it's like made out of putty.
Yeah, that's not right. That it shouldn't be like that.
Who knows? Maybe it's the weather. You know what else is going on? Are you affected by the storm? And by storm, I mean tree pollen.
Oh, I thought you were going to say conservatism.
Oh, my gosh.
Tree pollen? I think so. I feel a little stuffed up.
Please, have some. There are some. What? Yeah. It catches you.
Uh-huh.
There are some afflicted folks out there. And, in fact, I read on some of the national, the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases, they give guidance on allergens, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And did you know that a side effect of climate change and the heating of our climate is higher production of pollen?
Why can't there be a single good side effect of climate change? You know, would it have been so hard for nature to say, okay, climate change is going to happen, the global ice, you know, the sea will be rising, but pollen levels will go down? I mean, give us something, one little thing.
Oh, it's a nasty thing, pollen itself. So there are people sniffling, I know other producers and all kinds of, here at the radio station, but everybody out there just mm-hmm. getting by, trying to manage their symptoms. I imagine, I mean, there's maybe a better understanding, better treatments now, but it's worse for people who maybe are younger or are just becoming aware that they're allergic and figuring out how they respond. I think older folks who've been exposed to more over time, their symptoms tend to dissipate. That has been said as well, but mm-hmm. this sort of new impact that's coming back at us as a result of maybe human activity and overall change, I found that amazing. I didn't realize that was yet another impact. So, and that causes severe distress to people like asthma, having an acute attack of some kind. It's a real danger. So, and the funny thing is, when you read regular pollen, you know, you kind of have to know the criteria a little bit, because you would have been fooled. This is in the middle of it. The 3 days here are mm-hmm. very severe, but only for trees. And if you go outside, you'll see it everywhere.
What do you mean? Only, you know, trees have suffering?
Well, of the categories of pollen, there is a breakdown. So overall, you might read a forecast, and it's weird. I don't know where the...
Oh, trees are causing...
They're among the highest categories.
I thought they were suffering from it. No, okay. That doesn't make any sense.
If you want to anthropomorphize people as trees, I don't know. That's a different discussion.
A sneezing tree. Wow, that would be something.
A sneezing tree. That is a great band name.
It's also a great, like, beat poetry name.
Yes, and next performing tonight here at the WSB Cafe is Sneezing Tree. Everybody give a loud snap.
I was thinking of the name of a poem, but it works as an artist.
Oh,
name too.
I thought that was a performer.
Well, I haven't decided yet. It's only like 5 seconds old.
Sneezing Tree.
Sneezing Trees.
By
Emmanuel.
Oh, and
I have pluralized it. Yeah. Okay, well, there's a lot to think about there. But
this is a one-time reading of Sneezing Tree.
Yeah, hopefully.
It will never occur again in this springtime of Aquarius.
Well, I definitely got something going on in my throat because I'm going to have to cough a lot. So I don't know if it's allergies or just...
That's why I'm telling you, this is it's real and it's mm-hmm. happening. It is a storm of pollen. Beware.
Okay, so what am I supposed to do about that?
No, I don't know. Tell a friend.
All right. Oh, boy. Well, it's going to be a cheery show. We're going to talk about Israel for most of it. But before we get into that, a little aside. I can see... Did you watch this press conference this morning out of North Carolina? It was so disgusting.
This is about Andrew Brown?
Andrew Brown Jr., who was shot and killed by sheriff's deputies in North Carolina, I believe back in April. He was in his car. He was shot in the back of the head. And today, you got to see the lawyer for the sheriffs, otherwise known as the district attorney. And that's really not the way it's supposed to work, is it? But, yeah, he was up there, and you know, he was, you know, when I first started watching this, I thought, okay, he's trying to justify the shooting by saying there were all these gun casings found around the scene. He kept listing all these gun casings, but every single one of them belonged to the cops because the guy was unarmed. He was listing them, I don't know why, out of a sense of pride or something, saying, yeah, we fired 6 rounds here and 7 rounds there, and basically just an inventory of all the bullets that were fired. And there's nothing wrong with that, apparently. He basically went on to describe the situation. Well, first of all, I don't know if people have seen the video. There's a video I was circulating a few weeks ago of all these cops on a pickup truck. It was like some kind of Deep South execution squad. You see them just basically driving through residential streets, all standing on the back of a pickup truck, all with heavy armaments, you know, guns, and they're there to arrest this guy. And you know, he's not a Charles Manson or, you know, somebody who's a mass shooter or something like that. I think it was on a drug count or something. Certainly nothing to require that kind of a response, but that's how they do things. So these people arrived, and I guess he was a bit startled by that. He tried to get away, and that led to his execution. And that's really what it was an execution. The way it was described today didn't do anything to change that perception. The district attorney, his name is Andrew Womble. He said that Andrew Brown used a deadly weapon and had to be put down because of that. And, you know, watching this, you say, oh, he had a deadly weapon. Okay, he was firing on the cops. I guess they had to fire back. No. The deadly weapon happened to be the car he was in. Yeah, that's the deadly weapon. So when you redefine a car as a deadly weapon, okay, now you can get away with some things. So how is this a deadly weapon? Well, instead of complying, and yeah, he didn't comply. Again, is this a reason to lose your life? Apparently in North Carolina it is. He instead backed up his car, and judging from the video that they showed, it's very blurry and fast-moving. They claim that a cop was hit by the car. You see a hand slapping the hood or something like that. You know the closing credits of The Odd Couple, when Oscar is crossing the street and he sees a beautiful woman and he does a U-turn and then he resumes his route, and a car, I think it's a taxi, almost hits him because it has the light now. It was like that. You know? In their world, Oscar Madison could have shot that cab driver for almost running him down with a deadly weapon. But it was nothing more than that. It was just maybe a tap. And then he drove off, and he was basically cornered. They even said this in the press conference. They said the car was cornered. And yet, these cops felt they were in danger. If the car is cornered, I mean, I can think of 20 ways to have brought this to a better conclusion. You pull your damn pickup truck in back of it, he can't get out now at all. You surround him, there's enough of you, and wait for him to see reason that he can't escape. No shots. No need for that. There was no need for this. And what we saw today was just basically over an hour of justifying murder. And it was one of the most disgusting things I've ever seen. It's not getting nearly enough media coverage. I don't know why. I mean, they did a really good job of painting this guy as, you know, persona of evil. He had a record. He had drug convictions. It's all irrelevant. Whether you're Mother Teresa or, you know, a drug dealer, when you're being apprehended by cops, you should not be executed simply for not obeying orders. You know, there's a word for that kind of a society. So that was a great way to start the day, seeing that. And I don't know what the reaction is going to be. I hope something happens. I hope federal authorities do something about this, or that there's massive uprisings against this sort of thing, because, you know, if you let it happen, if you just let it go, excuse it, it's just going to keep happening. How many times do we have to say this? It keeps happening over and over and over again. Pick your city, pick your state. So that's the case of Andrew Brown Jr. The sheriff's deputies were justified in shooting him in the back of the head. And when you think about it, how are you about to run somebody over? How is your life in danger if the person is facing the other way? It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And you know, a lot of he was asked questions by the press afterwards. One of the questions being, well, couldn't you have apprehended him later? And no, we had to apprehend him now. That was not an option. We could not delay this. And you just want to say, why? Why are you being such a jerk? Why do you insist on making a tense situation so much worse and murdering somebody just to prove your authority? This is everything that's wrong with policing in this country right now. And if we blindly support this sort of thing, then there's something wrong with us as well. So, please, put the blue flags away. Ask some serious questions. Ask yourself how this could have been handled better. And if you really don't think that could have been handled better, I don't know. I don't know what to say to you. Anytime somebody gets killed in this kind of a situation, it's a failure, a massive failure. And in this case, probably a crime.
Is it going to deter that reaction? Probably not. People will be just as scared.
Are you kidding? People are going to run all the more now
when
they see cops coming. It was an execution squad.
Right. It did look like some country bumpkin, you know, back of the... It really did look like good old boy, you know, stuff you see... out of the 50s or you know, last century.
Try the 20s and the 21st century.
Yeah, maybe I'm thinking of films of that era, but like To Kill a Mockingbird, I think.
Oh, there's going to be some good films that come out of this. Yeah. If we're looking for some good cinema, we're inspiring a whole lot of it now.
I'm not trying to conflate the two.
Yeah.
Certainly not, but... it's not going to deter that behavior. It will make people just as fearful. They will not feel as though they're going to get a just view in the eyes of the law.
Don't get fooled by the personality or the history of the individual involved. That's not the point. That is absolutely not the point. It's how individuals are treated by the system, and they're supposed to be treated fairly, justly, and no matter what. You know, if this guy was firing, you know, weaponry at the cops, you know, that's a situation where obviously you have to do something about that. Your life is in immediate danger. With what I saw, and from what they've released, which is precious little, and they're censoring and blocking things out and being very obstinate as far as what they're sharing. But from what I could see, there was no threat to their lives at all. I mean, you know, we're talking about maybe the kind of mentality where, you know, if you tap a cop on the shoulder, you've assaulted him. If that is how you choose to define your terms, then okay, yes, I guess they were under attack because the car moved at, 1 mile an hour in their direction. It's a ridiculous situation. And, you know, it's kind of a parallel to our next topic here, which is what's going on in Israel, in Palestine. I want to give a little bit of background to this because, boy, there's a lot going on, and there's so much. And nobody knows everything, and nobody is unbiased. We have Gaza Live over here on YouTube.
Yeah, notice that. There's a pretty good amount of streams and basically just vantages of the city, of the region.
Well, there's one less. The Associated Press had a good one. in their high rise, which was destroyed by Israel.
I heard about that
a few days ago. But this is Reuters. Hopefully they're safe for a little while. You know, you could go back a day, a week, a month, 10 years, or thousands of years, and you're not going to get a resolution. You're not going to get agreement. But you might get a little bit of understanding if you know a few things. So let's go back 27 days before the first rocket was fired out of Gaza. A lot of people, especially in this country, seem to think that's when everything starts, when Hamas fires a rocket. If you look at the headlines are always so apologetic. Every newspaper, it's always Israel destroys an apartment building filled with people in response to Gaza firing a lame-ass missile that didn't hit anything. You know, it's never Israel did this and Hamas or Palestinians in general responded in this way. No. It's always they're first, and Israel is just responding, defending themselves. Everyone says that. Everyone says Israel has the right to defend themselves. Sure, everyone has the right to defend themselves. Is bombing civilians to oblivion, is that defense or is that offense? You know, those of you who play football, you know this. You know what the difference is.
Yeah, over and over again you hear this is a defensive action.
Strange way of defending yourself.
It's never looked at. I mean, you're talking about moving forces and using different types of weaponry and stuff, but it's never considered an action on your part. It's always to protect something from a threat.
You know what's defensive? Defending yourself, the Iron Dome. This is what Israel has. It's an amazing system. And I don't think anybody really has much bad to say about it because they see missiles coming in and they shoot them down and they get almost every one. They don't get all of them, but they get almost every single one. And I was thinking to myself, hey, you know, what a great thing for the Palestinians to have is an Iron Dome that can do the same thing for the missiles that are coming towards them. But people get upset when you suggest this. Why? Palestinians have to accept all the rocket fire that they have coming to them. You know, if they build defensive systems, that means they can't be bombed. And if they can't be bombed, then they'll never learn. And it's just so disgusting, the arguments that people twist themselves into.
Well, if they can't be bombed, they'll keep protesting their occupation in other circumstances of their living circumstances.
That's the thing. They're protesting. And that is the real threat to this apartheid society, which is what Israel has become, or perhaps always was. And it's sad. It's so sad. But let's go back. 27 days before that first rocket was fired from Gaza, a squad of Israeli police officers entered the Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem. They pushed the Palestinian attendants aside. They strode across this vast limestone courtyard. Then they cut the cables to the loudspeakers that broadcast prayers to the faithful from four medieval minarets. Israeli police just did that. That was on April 13th. That was the first day of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. It was also Memorial Day in Israel, which honors those who died fighting for the country. And guess which one took priority? The Israeli president was delivering a speech at the Western Wall, a sacred Jewish site that lies below the mosque, and Israeli officials were concerned that the prayers would drown it out. The prayers for Ramadan might drown out the president's speech. You can't make this stuff up. Well, according to the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Sheikh Ikrimah Sabri, this was the turning point. Their actions would cause the situation to deteriorate. And how could it not? You defile a religion like that. You take something sacred. You trivialize it. You stomp over it. You don't expect a reaction to that? You don't expect hostility? And this is the outgrowth of years of blockades and restrictions in Gaza, decades of occupation in the West Bank, decades more of discrimination against Arabs within the state of Israel. According to Avraham Berg, former Speaker of the Israeli Parliament, all the enriched uranium was already in place, but you needed a trigger, and the trigger was the Aqsa Mosque. So, that is one of the beginnings. Now, basically, the mosque leadership is overseen by the Jordanian government, and they had rejected an Israeli request to avoid broadcasting prayers during the speech, viewing that request as disrespectful. And so the cops came and disconnected the speakers. Without a doubt, said Sheikh Sabri, it was clear to us that the Israeli police wanted to desecrate the Aqsa Mosque and the holy month of Ramadan. And it's not hard to reach that conclusion, because if you put yourself in that situation, much like we're talking about with the cops in North Carolina, okay, you have the situation where you happen to have your holiday on the same day as another religion's holiday, and you happen to be literally right on top of each other. Well, how do you deal with the situation? You come over and say, hey, do you mind shutting up for a little while our leader speaks, our political leader speaks, and maybe put your religion on mute for a little while? Could you do that for us? No? Okay, then we're going to cut your wires. No. Better way of dealing with that would be go over to those same people and say, this is a special day for us too. What can we do to accommodate you? They're the ones making the request. They're the ones who should be making the sacrifice. What can we do to make things easier for you? How hard is it to say something like that? A resurgent sense of national identity among young Palestinians found expression not only in resistance to a series of raids on Al-Aqsa, but also in protesting the plight of six Palestinian families facing expulsion from their homes. And what a story this is. Yeah, it's only six families. But what it symbolizes, what it shows, is so emblematic of what has been going on in this region. The perceived need to placate an increasingly assertive far right gave Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel's caretaker prime minister, little incentive to calm the waters. He really doesn't care at all. These shifts in the Palestinian dynamics caught Israel unawares. Israelis had been complacent, nurtured by more than a decade of far-right governments that treated Palestinian demands for equality and statehood as a problem to be contained, not resolved. Think about that. Just containing the situation, not trying to fix it. Now, the loudspeaker incident was followed almost immediately by a police decision to close off a popular plaza outside the Damascus Gate, which is one of the main entrances to the Old City of Jerusalem. Young Palestinians typically gather there at night during Ramadan, another religious tradition. A police spokesman said the plaza was closed to prevent dangerously large crowds from forming there and to head off the possibility of violence. Interesting that Israeli crowds don't have those same restrictions. Yeah. To Palestinians, it was another insult, led to protests, which led to nightly clashes between the police and young men trying to reclaim the space. So many feel they're gradually being pushed out of Jerusalem. And it's hard to argue. Restrictions on building permits force them to either leave the city or build illegal housing, which then is vulnerable to demolition orders. So the decision to block Palestinians from a treasured communal space compounded the sense of discrimination that many have felt all their lives. And people have grown up with this all their lives. It made it feel as though they were trying to eliminate our presence from the city, said Majid al-Kamari, a 27-year-old butcher from East Jerusalem. We felt the need to stand up in their faces and make a point that we are here. The clashes at the Damascus Gate had repercussions. Later that week, Palestinian youths began attacking Jews. Some posted videos on TikTok, getting public attention. And that is a terrible thing, no question. and it soon led to organized Jewish reprisals. But listen to how those went. April 21st, just a week after the police raid, a few hundred members of an extreme right Jewish group, known as Lahava, marched through central Jerusalem chanting death to Arabs. Death to Arabs, and attacking Palestinian passersby. A group of Jews was filmed attacking a Palestinian home. Others assaulted drivers who were perceived to be Palestinian. I'm sure we all saw videos of the many fires that were set to Palestinian land, to Palestinian homes. Very much reminiscent of some other disturbing events that took place in European history over the past century. Yeah. It's so disturbing to see, especially in these circumstances. Foreign diplomats and community leaders tried to persuade the Israeli government to lower the temperature in Jerusalem, at least by reopening the square outside Damascus Gate, but they found the government distracted and uninterested. Netanyahu was in the middle of coalition negotiations after yet another election in March. Didn't have a clear winner, so he's trying to form a coalition, and he needed to persuade a bunch of extreme right lawmakers to join him. And one of those was Itamar Ben-Gvir, who was a former lawyer for Lahava, who advocates expelling Arab citizens whom he considers disloyal to Israel, and until recently had hung a portrait of Baruch Goldstein. That's a Jewish extremist who massacred 29 Palestinians in Hebron in 1994. He hung a portrait of that maniac in his living room. So Netanyahu was accused of pandering to people like this and fomenting a crisis to rally Israelis around his leadership by letting tensions rise in Jerusalem. I'm sure any Israelis listening now know that's true. That is what this is about. Netanyahu didn't invent the tensions between Jews and Arabs, said Anshel Pfeiffer, a political commentator and the prime minister's biographer. They've been here since before Israel was founded, but over his long years in power, he stoked and exploited these tensions for political gain time and again, and has now miserably failed as a leader to put out the fires when it boiled over. So we had the looming eviction of the six families, and a final court decision on their case was due in the first half of May. There were regular protests being held since April, demonstrations that accelerated after Palestinians drew a connection between the events at Damascus Gate and the plight of the residents. Meanwhile, the police, who said they were responding to violence by demonstrators in Sheikh Jarrah, but the video and images show they engaged in violence themselves. And these images began to circulate online. The neighborhood turned into a rallying point for Palestinians, not just across the occupied territories in Israel, but all throughout the world where Palestinians live. The experience of the families who had already been displaced from what became Israel in 1948 was something every single Palestinian can relate to. That's according to Jahan Saiso, a Palestinian poet living in Lebanon. And it highlighted a piece of legal discrimination. Israeli law allows Jews to reclaim land in East Jerusalem that was owned by Jews before 1948, but the descendants of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who fled their homes that year have no legal means to reclaim their family's land. How about that? How is that for discrimination? These families have lived there since the 1940s, at least, and expected to be kicked out because of this. And a similar situation doesn't apply to them. So, basically the police continued raiding the Aqsa Mosque, and on a Monday morning after the Palestinians stockpiled stones in anticipation of clashes with the police and far-right Jews. And for the second time in 3 days, stun grenades and rubber-tipped bullets were fired across the compound in scenes that were broadcast across the world. And then, shortly after all that, the rocket fire from Gaza began. So when you see a headline saying that Israel's responding to rocket fire, well, look at all that happened beforehand, just in the past couple of weeks. It wasn't out of nowhere. And people can only be pushed so far. Now, Hamas are a bunch of bastards. They're no friend of anybody, as far as I can see. But the Palestinian people have no say in that at all. Yes, they were elected, I think, in, 2006? And why were they elected? Because of situations like this. They'd be elected again today, and it's because of Israel's actions that they will elect anybody that appears to be fighting back, no matter how corrupt and horrible they happen to be. But you cannot blame civilians for the militants that are firing missiles. You just can't. But that is exactly what Israel is doing, and not having to pay any penalty for this. The American reaction has been disgusting. My God, have you heard Joe Biden? Well, he hasn't really said anything, has he? All he said is Israel has the right to defend themselves. What does that mean? And are you saying Palestinians don't have the right to defend themselves? And how do they do that exactly? You know, they can't stop the missiles from coming. You don't want them firing rockets. Well, what exactly are they supposed to do? And the answer is always stop. Stop doing what you're doing. Again, individual people, the hordes of people who are crowded into this small space, they have no control over this situation. And you know this. You absolutely know this. And it doesn't stop there. There was an Israeli airstrike on Saturday, destroyed a high-rise building that housed the Associated Press and Al Jazeera. And that was despite repeated urgent calls from the news agency to the military to halt the impending attack. See, what they do is, I don't know how they get everyone's phone number, but they call people and say, hey, we're about to destroy your building. You have 1 hour to leave. It's literally what they do. I mean, if it wasn't so tragic, it would be funny. So there's this strange relationship between the Israeli authorities and the people living in Gaza, where you can get a phone call at any time and to tell them your life is about to be overturned. And there's nothing you can do about it. The people at the AP were on the phone begging the Israeli military to either stop or delay this, and we're told there was nothing they could do. Yeah, right. Gary Pruitt, AP's president and chief executive, we are shocked and horrified that the Israeli military would target and destroy the building housing AP's bureau and other news organizations in Gaza.
Al Jazeera as well.
Yep. This is an incredibly disturbing development. We narrowly avoided a terrible loss of life. And what if they hadn't? What if they hadn't avoided that? What if they weren't able to get out in time? What if there was somebody inside sleeping that couldn't be reached? Absolutely disgusting. And this is because Hamas supposedly had an office in that building? That's to destroy an office? First of all, you know, whatever goes on in an office can go on almost anywhere. So, what? And if you warned everybody, well, then they got out too. So what did you accomplish?
They could dismantle coverage.
That's pretty much what they did. They dismantled coverage. As the AP said, the world will know less about this now. And the reaction from the states is just so underwhelming. Democrats and Republicans alike. But it's taking on an added tone when you let Republicans keep talking. Mitch McConnell, for instance, we're already seeing some push the false narrative that this conflict is a tragic dispute between two legitimate combatants where both sides share blame that is roughly equal. What nonsense. Yeah. 200 civilians killed, and he calls it nonsense.
Our silence or lack of skepticism about what's being said by the Israeli defense and government political establishment, as well as the coverage therein is completely motivated by the lack of truth that is coming out of there.
Mm-hmm. If you listen to Mike Pence, remember him? He is getting all defensive about this. Unlike the Trump-Pence administration, I've never even heard that phrase before. Unlike the Trump-Pence administration, we made it crystal clear to the world that America stands with Israel. But now, President Biden has sent the world a profoundly different message. Instead of seeking peace through strength, he has invited violence through weakness. When? How? What did he say? He's basically saying word for word what every U.S. president has said. Israel has the right to defend itself. We stand behind Israel. What? Mike Pence, that's not strong enough? Really? I don't get it. No matter what, they will just find fault somehow. But literally, he's saying the same things. Pence goes on to say there is no moral equivalency between Israel and the terrorist group Hamas. Okay, but you know what? That's not who's dying. I mean, yeah, they're targeting leaders of Hamas, but they're killing so many civilians in the process, children. They're not members of Hamas. And you better believe there's a moral equivalency between innocent children of one country and innocent children in another. I mean, it'd be like saying, yeah, it's perfectly okay to target kids in Israel because we don't like Netanyahu. Imagine if we said that. Imagine if a leader of a country, leader of our country, said something like that. Yeah, we don't like to kill children, but we have to because Netanyahu's a jerk. So, when the Israeli people get rid of Netanyahu, we'll stop targeting their kids. How does that sound? It gets worse. Senator Tom Cotton, Republican of Arkansas, now he's taking aim at the Associated Press. He said, how dare they share a workspace with Hamas? Yeah, we said there was an international outcry among journalists over the weekend after Israel destroyed the building. Why is the Associated Press sharing a building with Hamas? Cotton asked yesterday. Surely these intrepid reporters knew who their neighbors were. Did they knowingly allow themselves to be used as human shields by a U.S.-designated terrorist organization? Did the AP pull its punches and decline to report for years on Hamas's misdeeds? He went on to mock the whiny reporters who had shifted the Israeli-Hamas conflict to focus on themselves. I submit that the AP has some uncomfortable questions to answer. Yet the AP and its fellow journalists are in high dudgeon about Israel's wholly appropriate airstrike. Leave it to whiny reporters to make themselves the story and the victim when terrorists are shooting missiles at innocent civilians. My God. That is the reaction from Republicans in our country, to blame the victims repeatedly. It is so disgusting. I mean, I'm sorry, Kyle, while I gather myself, please step in.
Well, we, by substantiating what they say and not critiquing it, perpetuate something that isn't necessarily true, but it's thought to be true because we're not challenging it. So by these remarks, we're substantiating that, and it is a climate of impunity. They get away with this. They're not challenged. It's an outsized competition, if you want to call it that. And we're allowing it in many regards. So without being able to critique how people are treated there, and in fact going further with whatever the line is about how things went and the disparities there, they remain able to commit the kind of violations against humans there that we're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm reminded of a lot of the activities and things that have gone on in the past. And one case that came to mind, because it happened early on in my education, was the case of Rachel Corrie, who was killed by a bulldozer.
American, yes.
Yeah. I don't want to get into the whole specifics of it, how it went, but I know the district court did not find the IDF at fault.
Of course not.
And Jimmy Carter at the time was commenting on it, saying the court's decision confirms a climate of impunity which facilitates Israeli human rights violations against Palestinian civilians in the occupied territory.
He said that. Well, he wasn't president then.
No.
When he was president, he didn't say things like
no,
that.
No.
Yeah.
As former president.
Right.
But at the time of that case.
Mm-hmm.
And if you just kind of look, she was there on a school trip, but was affiliated with ISM, which was a protest organization, and they were at a site that was being bulldozed, and it was displacing people, and she was run over by an armored bulldozer.
And not by accident, on purpose.
Well, that was the case, that was what the case was about. That was filed by her parents in Israel with attorneys and so forth in the aftermath of it. But at the time, you just unpack the scenario. An armored bulldozer that's there supposedly for tunnels and other things, and as a consequence also displacing people. Well, why are there tunnels? Well, because there's blockades on supply. You know, you have these layers and layers of circumstances.
Right.
Why are then people pushed to go and say, hey, you shouldn't bulldoze this area? It's because of all the other things that have compounded. And that's, I think, a great example. And we've seen other examples of this up until this day. And I was just, that came to me as something that I remember growing up.
You know, a situation like this, we mentioned apartheid. And remember South Africa, remember the apartheid system. Israel is an apartheid nation at the moment. And the only way that changes is intense pressure. And the only way intense pressure can be applied is through campaigns. Now, BDS has gotten a lot of attention, and I think a lot of unfair characterization. I think our listeners are mature enough to look into it for themselves and visit the website bdsmovement.net and learn about how boycotts and other protests can actually have an effect. And I would say it is having an effect because the pushback against it is so strong, it must be hurting. And some pain deserves to be felt for this horrible way of treating people.
I believe today there are calls for a general strike.
Good. I hope there's a lot.
There are probably other calls from movements like that as
well. People can make a difference a lot more than they are ever told they can. We're going to do this? Okay. It's our feature, Films of the Year That Was, where we see Oscar-winning films year to year. And yeah, this could work, actually. We saw the 1998 winner for the international film. If you recall, last week when we reviewed Shakespeare in Love, we mentioned that the film Life is Beautiful lost because Shakespeare won, but Life is Beautiful happened to win the best film on the international level, so we get to review it anyway. And I'm glad, because it was a really good film, I thought, about, well, kind of insufferable. A lot of people didn't like it because it seemed to be making humor out of the Holocaust, and it really wasn't. I think that's very unfair. It's about a father who is trying to keep the evils of what is actually going on as they're in a concentration camp, trying to keep that from his 5-year-old kid and turn it into a game. Yeah, it's the ultimate Holocaust denial, I know, but done for the purest of reasons. What do you think, Kyle?
Oh, that's the thing there. It was this like playful thing where to protect the son his experience and shelter a bit in light of the tumult that is thrust upon the protagonists. It is an interesting response, a human response to coping in the historic scenario they're undergoing. And he's in love with this woman and persistent, committed to being in her life. His name is Guido.
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 Guido?
Guido Orefici.
Uh-huh.
And it's set in Tuscany, in Italy.
And it's played by Roberto Benigni.
That's right.
And directed by him as well.
That's right.
And yeah, he was, you know, very upbeat, happy character. It just, you know, after a while you might get annoyed by that because it is a damn concentration camp, for God's sake.
But it's a comedy drama.
Well, yeah, it's a real tragedy.
Comedy because he sets up these ways of bumping into her because he's persistent.
Well, that's before all the really bad stuff happens. I'm talking about when he's in the concentration camp with his kid. And she actually, even though she's not Jewish, volunteers or demands to go to the concentration camp as well. But men and women are kept separate, so they never actually see each other. Just so many levels of true tragedy and heartbreaking portrayals there. But it's a fascinating parallel to what we're seeing now, where people are just victimized because of who they are, where they were born, what they represent. And, God, you know, you would think, coming out of that, we would know better. We would know better about how to deal with conflict, with change, with evolution. And I guess seeing it now kind of was depressing.
Yeah. Yeah. And in the end, the sort of coming around full circle, the game he makes... it ends with an Allied tank, which, as a part of the game, he had promised his son that he would get a tank, a real tank,
yeah,
out of this. And, of course, he had already been in the intervening chaos of this war and the camp being taken over or otherwise freed. His father's killed, and he ends up... emerging from his hiding place as he's been gaining points and going along with his dad's instructions.
Spoiler alert, by the way.
Yeah. Well, we're here to spoil these films, but
if you haven't figured it out by now, yes, that's the purpose.
We've been
destroying them since the 1800s now. But yeah, Life is Beautiful. It's you know, I saw it before. It's bittersweet for sure.
But a weird wistfulness from His female interests of wanting to be there with him to the end.
Yeah, I think that's something that we all need to exercise a little bit, is the desire not to simply, you know, wish the unfortunates away, but to be there with them and to fight for them whenever possible. Okay, we only have one more year in the 1900s, so we're moving into the 2000s afterwards. I'm careful not to say 21st century. I know 2000 isn't technically the 21st century, but it's a turning point.
Benigni is really well known for jumping up on stage just as he did in the movie.
Yeah, and I remember the Oscar Awards.
The
I think you remember
speech.
That too. Yeah, he basically jumped. He somehow made it to stage by jumping on top of chairs on the way to the stage.
It was something like that as a cute,
that's
cute reference.
More entertaining than the film in some ways.
Some. On to the next, though.
Well, you know, I still have a couple of facts I'd like to share as far as history. And again, I am not an expert by any means. I know very, very little about the history. But I do know a few things. And I'm always open to being proven wrong on these things. But, for instance, when you call Palestinians anti-Semitic, you can't do that. They're a Semitic people. Okay. I mean, Arabic is a Semitic language, so you can't say they're anti-Semitic. In fact, Israel is anti-Semitic, if you want to go that way, by destroying Palestinian homelands and constantly attacking those people and hating them for who they are. So there's that. You know, if you want to say there, and it's, that's not to say that there isn't horrible racist and nationalistic speech being hurled in all directions. But let's call it what it is. And I think in most cases it's anti-Zionism. And Zionism is, it's basically racism. The United Nations had it right. I think this was in the 1970s where they said this. It's basically the political goal of creating a Jewish state in order to create a nation where Jews could be the majority rather than the minority, which they had been, since they were basically cast out in the 8th century B.C. Yeah. So when we're talking about return to Israel, that's how much time has passed. So, you know, respecting that kind of history, going that far back, that's a great thing to do. But you also have to respect the things that have happened in all the time that has occurred between now and way back then. And that includes people who have lived in the same house for nearly a century. So there's so much to look into here, so much to study and to learn. For instance, Hebrew wasn't spoken commonly until the 1800s. It had died out. And it's rejuvenated, and I think it's a good thing. And I think it's a great thing to have a homeland. But you know, there was a choice between where this homeland could be. It might have been Argentina. It might have been East Africa. They finally decided, the Mideast is the best place for historical reasons. That's literally how it came about. It could have been somewhere else. So you have to put all this into context when you see people who are pointing at tradition and customs and history. There are many different ways of looking at the situation currently. And they all need to be respected, and they're all not being respected right now. Well, I figured we'd go out with some Palestinian music. This is from a very talented DJ named Bruno Cruz. A song called Dusty Floor.
We didn't even get to talk about the weapon systems we've been selling.
Out of time, Kyle. Out of time. We need more time. Write to us, otw@2600.com. Gotta go.
Good night.
أو عن بيلته